everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace.
I'm Manny.
This episode, we're going to hear about Manny's trip to the Stan Lee's Comic-Con, formerly Stan Lee's Kamikaze, down in L.A., and we're also going to talk about the DC Rebirth books for November 9th. We're not going to talk about all the books. Maybe we'll touch on a few of them real briefly. Try to keep this episode about an hour. Started the new job. I thought, I guess a little foolishly, I thought, yeah, I'm going to start the new job and I'm going to have nights off and it's going to be a lot easier. But I failed to take into account the early mornings and having to adjust to that schedule. So the first week was a little rough, really super tired. So hopefully we're going to get back on a regular schedule real soon. So tell us, Manny, first of all, I was disappointed I didn't get to go. The second year in a row, I've had a press pass to the show and haven't been able to go. So did you go Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, or which days did you go?
No, actually, I just went Saturday. I was kind of upset because I kind of wanted to go Sunday, but then you had told me that I think you were going to go Saturday, and then with the way we're working, with my wife working weekends and stuff, it just turned out that Saturday was the best day for me to go. So, yeah, I just went Saturday.
Oh, that sucks. I wanted to hear about the Con Man panel.
Yeah, I know. For whatever reason, they did all of that stuff on Sunday, not Saturday. So it was disappointing because, I mean, they had a lot more guests on Sunday this time rather than Saturday.
So how was it? Was there a lot of people there?
There was a ton of people. They broke record, I guess, for overall attendee to the convention. I think it was, the press release was 92,000 or something like that overall. But, I mean, this is downtown L.A. They're doing all types of construction. They had another event at the Staples Center. League of Legends was holding a tournament. And then on Sunday, they had a marathon that was going to run right through there also.
Wow.
I mean, you want to talk about traffic? It sucked getting in and out. But I reserved my parking beforehand, so I didn't have to really worry about it.
All right, so it's held in the same spot as WonderCon?
Yeah, downtown L.A. Convention Center. It was fairly packed.
It was in the same space, even like the same part of the convention center.
Yeah. Yes. Dead on, exactly the same.
Now, since you're only there one day, did you have a chance to like see everything, or do you think it's a 2-day show?
Nah, I was able to get it all done in one day. I mean, there was a point to the afternoon where I was pretty much done. I was just there, really taking photos, a lot of photos, and checking out some of the panels that they had on the main stage and things like that.
Was there a lot of vendors?
A lot of different sales stuff going on. Not a lot of comic book vendors per se. They had the usual amount that they have, but a lot of other companies and stuff selling things. I mean, I think State Farm even had they're selling insurance there too.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's really corporate, I guess I would say. And then the line for the stupid pop figures, man, was ridiculous. It literally spanned about from one end to the convention floor to about three quarters to the way.
Wow.
To the end. Because they had to have them, but here's what gets me though also about those exclusive Hot Topic figures is that you can get them online like the day after or so, and it's the exact same one.
Hmm. I guess people are worried they'd sell out or something.
I don't know, because even my nephew like sent me a picture of it. They had them at the stores, and he's like not so exclusive, I guess. And I was just, I don't know.
Now, how about the Artist Alley? How did that compare to other shows we go to all the time?
Long Beach's is better.
Yeah.
I mean, Norm was there, and a couple of other, Jeffrey Edwards was there, and a couple of other people that I recognize. But the quality of artists wasn't necessarily there. I'm not sure if it's because the artist or what, but I mean, I don't know. They had artists there. They just weren't the quality artists that you're really looking for. I mean, Scott Kolbisch was there too, but not a lot of names that necessarily recognize right off the bat.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard people seem to either really like that show or really dislike it. So it's not really a comic show. It's definitely a pop culture show. You plan on going back? Or is one of those...
You know, I don't know. It just depends because I did WonderCon, Long Beach. I mean, they do so many shows throughout the year that by the time I got to that one, everything just seemed repetitive.
Yeah.
Even to a certain degree, even the cosplayers, it's the same people that I had just seen a couple weeks ago at Long Beach.
Yeah.
And I had just seen them at another previous show. And then the only cool thing is that at this show, you do get a little bit more of the celebrity. So you have Stan Lee there, but then you also had, I can't remember. I'm so bad with names. Batman himself.
Kevin Conroy.
Kevin Conroy was there.
Adam West.
And then also Adam West, yeah. And then a lot of the regular Flash people. Candace Patton was there. Teddy Sears. And, but like again, a lot of these people that I had just seen either at Heroes and Villains and or at Long Beach as well. So... I just felt like it's a show that it just seemed really repetitive.
What about publishers?
Publishers, you had Top Cow was there, and talking to Dylan, he didn't sound very enthusiastic about going back in the near future. He's saying that maybe Top Cow needs to expand the horizons and do other shows not in the LA area because... you know, the people who are reading Top Cow are already reading it in LA because they're at every show.
Yeah.
But they need to expand their horizons to do other shows where maybe they don't know too much about Top Cow for whatever reason. And then other than that, Aspen Comics was there. And the ladies from Hex said hi because I got to talk to them for a little bit and picked up the newest issues that they had. And not other than that, I mean, no Marvel, no DC, no Image. A lack of publishers, definitely.
Did you get to see Jimmy and Amanda?
No, I got to see Jimmy from afar, but they had a panel in the morning. That's all I saw. I never saw a booth for them.
Huh. All right, fair enough. Well, it sounds like I didn't really miss much. So, I don't know, one of these days. I mean, I've heard from some people that it's great. I've heard from some people that it's not so great. So, it sounds like it's more on the not so great side. I mean, it has Stan Lee's name, so you'd think that they'd get a few more.
That's probably the coolest part of the show is the fact that I got to see Stan Lee, like, standing just a few feet away.
Yeah.
But other than that, like I said, if you go to as many shows as we go to, by the time October rolls around,
yeah,
you're kind of a little exhausted, and depending what I do next year, I may or may not go back to any at all. To that one specifically.
All right, well, let's get on to the books for this week. First book we're going to talk about is Action Comics number 967. Writers Dan Jurgens, arts by Tyler Kirkham, and the colors are by Arif Prianto. I'll let you take the lead on this one. What'd you think?
You know, I've always thought since Lex Luthor took over as Darkseid's replacement per se, that he got it with very little consequence and very little nothing really happened to him. He was able to come back to Earth and really want to play the role of Superman, but that role that he left in Apocalypse hadn't came back and to bite him yet. So I thought this was a great issue to start that off and say, oh, there we go. There's your consequences for holding the power, that the position that Darkseid did. And so I really look forward to seeing where this goes. With that being said, also, I want to know what he knows about the Clark Kent that nobody else does, because as Lois is touring through his lab, she sees that he's been monitoring him, but she doesn't want to make too big deal of it, so she just kind of lets it go for the moment. I really like the artwork in the book. It has a like thin ink lines, and it's just really clean. Overall, I thought this was a really good issue, and it's taking it to the next level, because I was really tired of hearing about Clark and the whole Doomsday thing got old, and I was starting to lose a little bit of interest in action, but this kind of revived it a little bit.
We have totally different reactions. So, 967 Men of Steel Part 1. I'll talk about the art first. It's Tyler Kirkham handling the pencils and the inks. So it's probably digital. One thing I didn't like about it is it very much feels digital. You know, it has that real slick feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it seems a little stiff to me. And I think it's the combination of it's all done digitally, including most likely the colors by Arif Priyantu, who has done a great job up to this point on action with the colors. But for some reason, with Tyler Kirkham's rendering and it feeling a little stiff, and then the combination of the colors, it just seems like everything has this sheen over it of just looking like a little plastic, you know? And maybe it's not even the color. Maybe it's just that sometimes, and it's not every panel by any means, but sometimes it looks really stiff. Like if you look at the splash page that has the title with John holding up the phone, it just looks, I don't care for his Jonathan Kent, the way he draws Superboy, and even as Superman to some extent. And he's drawn previous issues of Action Comics and it's never bothered me. I like the way he draws Lex very much. I like the way he draws Lois very much. But when he draws Superman, when he draws Superboy, in this particular issue, I wasn't feeling it. And it's not every panel, because sometimes they look okay. And so I guess maybe it's just a little inconsistency in the art, in the rendering, that feel of being a little stiff. What I do like is both his page layouts, the way he arranges the panels on the page, and his choices, his artistic choices within the panels themselves. He definitely keeps things interesting. The storytelling is solid, and he keeps he varies the angles. So I always like it when artists do that. So I do like the final page, the final splash page. I think the colors on that page, in contrast to some of the rest of the book, are done extremely well with that background that looks kind of washed out. It gives a good contrast. As far as the story itself, this is probably the first issue of Action Comics since Rebirth where I really felt it was kind of like by the numbers. Oh, so here we go. It had very much of a 90s Triangle era feel, and not necessarily in a good way. Up to this point, it's been focused on the main story of, okay, now there's this Clark. How is this pre-Flashpoint Superman going to fit into this? How is Lois going to take over for the New 52 Lois? And it's kind of all been the same kind of thing. And now in this one, it's the first time we really have, here's some generic villain of the week. And, that part, it just felt a little weak. Overall, the whole issue just felt like it's maybe the weakest issue that has come out so far. Still very, very good. I'd still probably give it a 6 or a 7 out of 10, so still above average, but definitely a little on the weaker side. I did enjoy the interaction with Superman and Superboy, and you know, furthering that plot thread of kind of trying to find out who Clark is with the whole building that got teleported, apparently, or translocated from Metropolis to some jungle halfway across the world. And I really like the interaction with Lois and Lex. You know, she's used to the Lex from pre-Flashpoint that she couldn't trust as far as she could throw him. And this Lex, you know, ever since Forever Evil, has really been trying to be on the side of the angels. So that dynamic's good as well. I didn't really think about... I mean, obviously, we see Apocalypse. We see the Mother Box. I hadn't really given much thought to any consequences for Lex Luthor having gained the power of Darkseid, like you said. So that does... It does raise the story up a notch, I guess you'd say. So it'll be interesting to see if that's really what they're trying to prevent, especially based on that image. Or if they're from an alternate future where Lex didn't ever lose the power after gaining it, and they've come back and things are different now. So I guess we'll find out in the next issue. So an okay issue, but not my favorite. Next up, we have All-Star Batman number 4, written by Scott Snyder, pencils by John Romita Jr., and inks by Danny Mickey, with colors by Dean White. The backup, also written by Scott Snyder, you have pencils and inks by Declan Shelby, and the colors are by his fiance, Jordi Belair. So, the problem with All-Star Batman, I feel, is been the same problem I've had since issue 2, and that was the fact that the first issue was so good, and it was such a promising start that I've expected more all along. And the biggest problem I have with this entire series is the pacing. I feel like, again, Scott Snyder's trying to tell this big epic story, and he doesn't want it to take as long as it took him to tell Zero Hour, because I'm sure he heard the rumblings that story kind of dragged. But this is going too fast. It's just choppy. It constantly feels choppy. And the art by John Romita Jr. is not doing him any favors. You know, I hear a lot of people, John Romita Jr. fans, that are like, ah, his art is so dynamic. It's so powerful. He's a great storyteller. I'm sorry. You know, sometimes his rendering can be okay, sometimes not. It's very inconsistent. But I oftentimes have the hardest time just figuring out what the heck is going on in some of these panels. I don't know what he's drawing. And so, you know, that's not helping the story at all either. I think with the right artist, maybe could kind of smooth over some of the choppiness of the story. But between the story, the pacing and the plotting being uneven and choppy art, yeah, this one's losing me real quick. And we still have yet to see Gentleman Ghost appear again. What kind of garbage is that? He shows up on the back of the truck, couldn't wait to see him fight Batman, and no, never see him again. Ridiculous. Just ridiculous. And I even thought the backup story this time was the weakest installment of that. It's the final installment. I mean, it did wrap up the story in somewhat of a satisfying way, but it still felt weak. The art was probably the worst art on the backup we've seen to this point. So, eh. That's pretty much how I felt about the issue. The whole thing was kind of eh. So, I don't know. Obviously, DC still has a lot of faith in it. I mean, Scott Snyder's pretty much the golden boy over there, so I have no doubt that we're going to keep getting advanced copies, so I'm going to keep reading it. But at this point, if I had to buy this book, like, I didn't even buy issue 4. I think I stopped with issue 3, because on top of it being choppy, both art-wise and story-wise, it's a $4.99 book. And to me, there's no way that this is worth $5. I'm sorry. Just my personal opinion. What do you think?
No, I completely agree with you. Half the time I have no idea what's going on. For whatever reason in this story, maybe it's just in this story, but Duke to me as whatever bat you want to call him, it's not working for me either. It just seemed really convenient for him to just be around, being so new, and it's just not clicking for me. Even how he's not really involved in like detective and things like that. I don't know. That part of the story I don't like either. And then just there's just some panels that are just so bad to look at. My, I guess you can say least favorite has to be the one where they have Batman, Duke, and Two-Face tied on, I guess they're like game boards or something like that, like spinning wheels. They look completely flat, like if they had already fallen over.
Oh yeah,
it's so bad. Just overall, it's just not worth my time. My moment where I was upset is they had the Royal Flush Gang and they're gone. I mean, they were there for a panel.
That was kind of funny though, but at least you saw some kind of thing. You know, it didn't just show them one panel and then they're gone. At least you saw them get, you know.
Well, one of these days you're gonna ask Scott about it. He's gonna be like, "What are you talking about? Gentleman Ghost has been in the panel the whole time. You just can't see him." And then you're gonna be like, "That's bullshit, man. That's not in the yeah." With the way this issue ended, it's only gonna get choppier, I feel.
Yeah, it's too bad. Maybe. You know, maybe like I said, when they switch artists, it'll improve. But not feeling it right now.
I don't know. Jock has a really weird. It's almost like an acquired taste.
Yeah, when is it he comes next? To
artwork.
Is he next for sure?
Yeah, it's between Romita and then it was Jock. I like Jock's work on Witches, but that's a whole different genre.
Yeah, his stuff's very muddy. It's very muddy. All right, well, let's move on here.
Yeah.
Batgirl and the Birds of Prey, number 4. Writers Julie and Shauna Benson. The art on this particular issue was by Roge Antonio, and the colors are by Alan Pasalacqua. So, continuing the Who is Oracle story, but this issue focused a lot on Helena Bertinelli. We kind of got her origin. We found out how she became Huntress. We got a lot of information on why she's hell-bent on getting revenge against these mafia families. So it was good because it really explained her motivations very in-depth, and you get a greater understanding of why she's doing what she's doing. But what's cool is that she's able to overcome her anger and really bond with both Barbara Gordon and Dinah Lance. And we're really seeing them start to become a team. We're a little closer to finding out who Oracle is. And so that's kind of the cliffhanger that the story ends on. And the last panel, it's like, it's almost like a Batcave homage in a way, you know. We see the computer with a bunch of screens. We see some costumes and cases. And clearly whoever this Oracle is has been studying Barbara Gordon for a long, long time. So I'm very curious to see who it is. If it's somebody that's a new character, if it's somebody we've seen before. Hopefully we find the answer next issue because I'm very, very curious. But the Benson sisters are continuing to do a very, very good job. Female-centric book. I can find no fault with it, really. The art by Roge Antonio. I find that I don't enjoy it as much as when Claire Rowe is on the book. But obviously, being that this is a bi-weekly book, she can't draw every single issue. So The art is okay. The colors by Alan Passalacqua are outstanding. That's really probably the best part about the art. So it continues to be a really, really good book. Solid 7 or 8 for this particular issue, I'd say. So, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again. If you're a fan of Birds of Prey, fan of Batgirl, or just a fan of books with strong female characters, definitely this is a book you should be reading. All right, next up we have Deathstroke number 6, written by Christopher Priest. Breakdowns by Larry Hama. The finished pencils are by Carlo Pagulian. Inks by Jason Paz and colors by Jeremy Cox. Deathstroke had been steadily improving. Issues 3, 4, and 5 were really, really good. Issue 6 is a step backward. We get introduced to, you know, Rose, Slade Wilson's daughter, has been in the last few issues. Now we finally see his son, Jericho, show up. And yeah, this was really a step backwards for me. It jumps around. You know, I know that Christopher Priest is a big fan of non-linear storytelling. And there have been flashbacks and some non-linear devices, plot devices used in the last couple issues. But in this particular issue, it was just very confusing. It jumped around so much. It reminded me of in the beginning, the first couple of issues where everything was so choppy and hard to follow. And I don't know, I couldn't get into it. And I feel like because I couldn't get into it, it made it even more hard to follow. But again, I think reading it in trade, it probably will read a lot better. So, not my favorite issue. Also, it's a very different dynamic with Larry Hama doing the breakdowns, the layouts for Carlo Pagulian. I'm sure it lets him go a lot quicker, but you can definitely tell the difference in the art. It's not quite as clean. It's not quite as dynamic. You know, when you have another artist do the breakdowns or the layouts, you're never quite sure, even if you talk it through, what their intention is. And so sometimes you can get this choppy feel, or where it just everything feels a little static, a little unfinished, not quite as clean as we've seen Pagulian in the past on the title, not quite as dynamic. It doesn't really leap off the page. So definitely a down issue for Deathstroke, and that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to leave it at that. Next up, we have Detective Comics 944. This is The Victim Syndicate Part 2. Writers James Tinian. Pencils by Eddie Barrows. Inks by Eber Ferreira. And colors by Adriana Lucas. I'll start off by talking about the art. The color specifically, Adriana Lucas. Incredible job on the colors. Great job making the Victim Syndicate seem very ominous. The entire issue takes place at night. I love the darks. The colors that he uses tend to be more dark, except when they're in the belfry. He brightens it up when needed. But the colors help it give an ominous mood, which suits this new villain team that we're meeting in these last couple issues, the Victim Syndicate. Also, the angles in the panels by Eddie Barrows are done extremely well. So the art in this issue, absolutely top-notch. I love how he turns the camera so often. You know, you go from one camera where it's tilted, or one panel rather, where it's like your point of view is tilted on a 45-degree slant. The next one will be, you know, level. The next panel, you're looking down from above. So he switches it up. It keeps it interesting. A great page layouts as well. You know, Eddie Barrows, I think, is one of the most underrated artists that works for DC. He loves to do like a splash page within other smaller panels inset. And so it gives a very much of a cinematic feel. As far as the story itself, James Tinian, or Tynan, I should say, is really coming up in the world as far as his talents as a writer. I love that he's advancing the story. I love that he's introducing this new villain group. I love that he mixes in team dynamic, especially now that we have Luke Fox on the team. And yet, we're still seeing the consequences of what the team feels with the loss of Tim Drake. And he's managing to keep all these balls in the air and keep it interesting and further develop characters like Clayface and Batwoman and Spoiler. So a really, really solid issue. I don't find this to be a negative, but if there's anything to nitpick that some people might not like, this is a very dialogue-heavy issue. There's a lot to read. I actually like that. I feel like it gives me more value for my dollar. So I was totally fine with that. But like I said, some people don't care for that. They subscribe to the theory that the pictures should tell the story. But then you get in with flashback and you lose real estate on the page and in the book. And so sometimes it's easier just to let the characters move the plot along. So yeah, I thought this was an incredible issue. Loved it. Really, really great. What did you think?
I thought it was really well done. There's a lot going on. I mean, you even have Bluebird kind of making an appearance back. Not of course dressed up as Bluebird, but as her alter ego, I guess you can call it.
Harper Row.
Harper, thank you. but it's a great direction to take, especially after a story like the Monster Men, and with also so much happening within the team, to bring up things of the past and to have a group like the villains, Victim Syndicate, of people who've been affected, innocent people who've been affected by Batman, by his villains, fights that they've had in encounters that they've had in the past, and now that they've been all scarred forever. And at the same time, the team themselves is dealing with still the loss of Robin, but they have almost call it a replacement in Fox. I'm glad because I really like Batwing. It's kind of like a Iron Man type bat suit, I guess. I think it's really cool, and I think it's a great way that Tini is gonna replace the tech guy. So it's like, all right, here's another tech guy, and he's a Fox, so he'll know what to do. He'll figure it all out. But I am very sold on the story because I want to know who their leader is and what relationship he has with with Batman. Because everybody else is explained very, very well, and now it's time to figure out what's going to happen next. So I found it. Yeah, there was a lot of dialogue, but it was very, very necessary, and it really adds depth to the story. Up to the point where Batman's even having a pretty heated discussion with with Leslie Tompkins. It's overall really, really good story. So that was pretty good. I gotta give it like an 8.
All right, up next we have Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 8, written by Robert Venditti, art by Ethan Van Sciver, and colors by Jason Wright. Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps has been so good the last couple of issues. We basically saw the end of Sinestro and Hal Jordan, the brawl to end all brawls between those two, apparently. Not exactly sure who survived, where they are. Hal's ring at first says it's going out to find Hal, but then it says there's an error, so we're not exactly sure what's going on there. We saw that Sornik Natu, Sinestro's daughter, brought the Yellow Lanterns that rejected Sinestro as their leader. They all escaped from New Korrigar. They met up with the Green Lanterns. Mogo has been replaced or has replaced Oa, has replaced the war world that was destroyed, New Korugar that was destroyed when Hal Jordan basically exploded. So we've got these yellow lanterns, we've got these green lanterns. They're all on MOGO, which is, you know, Sector 000 replacement. As I speculated a couple issues ago, maybe that's how the Green Lanterns are going to start to fill in their core. You know, they're missing, I don't know, 90% of the Green Lanterns they had before they got sucked into the previous universe. So they're definitely hurting right now. They don't have enough, anywhere near enough bodies to do what they need to do. And in the midst of this, they get called to Tomar Ri's planet. And, of course, they answer the call. Even though they know they're in terrible shape, they're vastly undermanned and underpowered, they're going to go. But it's basically a trap. And a classic DC villain shows back up. And being that the title of this story arc is Bottled Bite, I guess we should have known that it was going to be Brainiac. Not necessarily the Brainiac that we've seen most recently in the New 52, in Convergence specifically. This is a much more familiar looking Brainiac. But yet he's bottling things up like the new Brainiac did. So a lot of questions to be answered. I am very much invested. The art by Ethan Van Sciver is great. You know, he's one of the, if not the prototypical Green Lantern artist for the last, I don't know, 10 years, I guess you'd say. We also see the return of some Guardians, I guess you'd say. Guardians that we haven't seen in quite a while. So perhaps we'll see a return to somewhat of the status quo, with Venditti behind pulling the strings on the Green Lantern stories. I mean, anything can happen at this point. So I can't wait to see Hal Jordan return, because you know he's not really gone, and how that's going to happen. Why did the ring go and seek out the two Guardians that it did, these two Guardians in exile, Ganthet and Syed? Yeah. Great, great book. A lot of action, too. Usually when you have a story that's been building for so long, and really last month's or last issue's conclusion had been building since before Rebirth, because that happened long before when all the Green Lanterns disappeared, when Hal Jordan went renegade. I mean, that was, you know, that all happened a really long time ago, over a year that it's been building to this. So usually you have an issue like that that wraps up a long story, because we all know Venditti, you know, he likes to work in the long term. You have an incredible conclusion like that, and you kind of, not that they take an issue off, but the creative team will like to give you a chance to kind of catch your breath, get a catch-up issue, get kind of a status quo issue. Venditti has never done that with the Green Lantern books. It's always been this huge action, this incredible strife and incredible situations that he's putting the Green Lanterns through, like really pushing them to the absolute edge. And before they can even catch their breath, it's another thing. And they can get through that, and then it's another thing. And then they have not stopped. It's been nonstop action since he's taken over the book. It's been kind of one disaster after another, and them just trying to keep their heads above water. And so it's really making for an interesting dynamic in this corner of the DC universe, because it's almost like, man, these poor Green Lanterns can't catch a break. What do you think of the book?
I just thought it was pretty interesting. The whole thing with this ring is that I keep in mind that it's not your typical Green Lantern ring. This is one that Hal Jordan made himself, that he wielded out of his own willpower. So I'm not really surprised that it's specifically looking for him instead of trying to find a new host. But at the same time, where is he? Is he going to come back as world power itself, or how's that going to play out? So that's a really interesting part of this book. And then also with Brainiac now holding the Lantern Tower, they're going to get out, because I thought maybe the Yellow Lanterns were going to be around to help them out to get out of this, but I think they got bottled up in there with them because they disobeyed Stewart's command and ended up going to try and help out, and in the end it just ended up with everybody getting I didn't like the artwork as much as I have before. I'm not sure if this is a different... Is it the same artist as before?
It's been Van Sciver and Robson Rocha switching back and forth.
Not sure about this specific issue, but I'm not really digging the art on this issue. Some of the facial expressions are the ones that bug me the most. Not sure why, but other than that, it's a kind of cool starting off issue. We get to see the classic Starro, which we all love to hate. Are those Guardians part of an Indigo tribe, or are they just on that planet specifically?
No, I guess that they were exiled, and so I guess I guess that's where they chose to go when they were exiled. As far as the art and the facial expressions, I will say that sometimes Van Sciver has a tendency to over-render. Specifically, when he draws Sinestro, I feel like he puts too many lines in the face. So, I totally get where you're coming from. When he's drawing some of the other alien Green Lanterns, sometimes I just feel like he goes a little too far and it's a little off-putting. So I totally get where you're coming from.
I mean, like the Brainiac one looks fantastic, but then you go to the the Guardian face. Like, I don't know, it looks flat in comparison to the rest of his head. I don't know, it's weird, but I think it's just the humanoid type faces, but he seems to have handled a Brainiac. I don't know.
All right, well, the next book that we're going to talk about is New Superman number 5. The writer is Jean Luen Yang. Pencils by Victor Bogdanovic. Inks by Richard Friend, and colors by Hi-Fi. This is probably one of the best issues of New Superman so far. Again, we're really starting to see the evolution of Kenan Kong. We're seeing him grow. Really, he's grown so much since we first met him in issue 1. He really was unlikable. Definitely a bully. Definitely very, not narcissistic, but self-centered, let's say. So we get a great little bit of backstory about his family, his mother and father. Really, it feels like it comes across in the story as the first time that he and his father have really sat down and had a heart-to-heart and have a greater understanding of each other, and they seem to bond over their similar histories, what his father and mother went through growing up, and what Kenan himself is going through right now, trying to come to terms with his powers. Then it switches to all action, and we see his father willing to sacrifice himself, and not just himself physically, but his beliefs, his fight, the sacrifices that he's made all along to try to bring freedom and democracy to China. He's willing to give that all up to save the life of his son. And then when it turns out that they might have a chance to, maybe all is not lost, they might have a chance to still come together and meet on some common ground. It's very interesting, and especially because the backdrop for all this is China, which is a communist country. So there's that whole thing of, as long as they remain in China, can there really be a happy ending? So it's a good story. It's a character story with an interesting setting. I don't know how accurate it is. Jin Luen Yang, the writer, is Chinese, but I don't, you know, I think, I'm pretty sure he was born here in the United States. His parents are immigrants. So I don't know. And obviously, China doesn't have superpowered beings, so, you know, who's to say if this is how they would, you know, choose to try to control them or whatever. But it's in, be that as it may, it's an interesting story. I love the father-son dynamic. It all felt very realistic to me. And as I said, this is what I've been waiting for with this book, is to really see the growth of Kenan Kong and trying to live up to that name that he's given himself of the new Superman. The art, pencils by Victor Bogdanovich. You know, he's probably my favorite artist that's come on the scene in the last 3 or 4 years. I've said it before, I'll say it again, very reminiscent of Greg Capullo. A little bit of a cartoony style, a little bit of exaggeration of the facial expressions. Very clean lines, good rendering, good solid page layouts. He doesn't really switch it up too much in the panel layouts themselves. Everything's pretty much straightforward, but it works with his clean style. It's very much a classic comic book look. So the pencils by Bogdanovich, Richard Friend, of course, one of the best inkers in the business, always manages to get the best out of the pencils that he's working on. And Brian and Christy Miller over at Hi-Fi do a great job on the colors of this book. It's very primary, which helps give it, again, it contributes to that classic comic book feel. This is very much classic comic book art. You know, it's not super photorealistic, but it's pretty close. You get a little exaggeration in the face, facial expressions here or there, and those primary colors that Hi-Fi uses really help give the book the right feel. Very much suits the art and the story as well. Are you caught up on New Superman?
Yeah, I caught up on it.
What are your thoughts?
The latest one I read, and I was glad I caught up, because the whole dynamic between him and his dad was really cool, especially when it came down where he's going to have to make a choice of standing beside his father or standing with the team that he's been working with. I like the homage to the Action Comics that they have, where he's holding the police car over his head. That was a cool panel, and a lot of soul searching, it seems, for him for Kong to go through, not only just for figuring out what side he's going to be on, but also we find out that it has a lot to do with the way he can control his Superman abilities. So I thought that was all really well interweaved together. So it really makes for a way more interesting story going forward, where now his dad kind of has changed his own ideals. Well, no, actually, his dad didn't. His friends from the freedom. What are they called? The Freedom Fighter? No. Yeah, Freedom Fighters of China. They've kind of gone a little bit. Well, not a little bit. They've gone radical, and so now they want to just control everyone to reach their purpose, which of course is a radical way of thinking. So overall, a very, very good book, and I'm glad that I caught up with it.
What about the art?
The art was good. It's not unlike the Hal Jordan we see a ton of maybe even unnecessary detail. This is just really, really clean looking. When we are both fans of Richard's friend's inking, and obviously this is done well. And I like the bright colors of it. It's really, really fun to look at. And one of the better ones, I think, of this week.
All right. Up next, we have Supergirl number 3. No, I'm sorry, Red Hood and the Outlaws number 4, written by Scott Lobdell, art by Dexter Soy, and colors by Veronica Gandini. I know you didn't read this one. I'm just going to touch on it real briefly. The team is still forming. Two major events happen in this issue. It seems like Jason Todd has managed to gain the trust of Bizarro, keep Bizarro from basically killing him. And we also learned that Black Mask kind of always knew what Jason Todd was up to. Jason Todd was kind of trying to infiltrate Black Mask's organization and take it down from the inside by pretending to be an out-and-out villain. Black Mask knew all along what he was doing. That's the other big revelation we get in this issue. So it ends on a cliffhanger, but I have a feeling that what we saw go down in the first couple pages of this issue is what's going to, that being the relationship and the bond that Jason Todd formed with Bizarro, is going to be very important, and the way that he survives the cliffhanger that we see at the end of the issue. The art by Dexter Soy. He's a relatively newcomer to the scene, especially over at DC, and he's handling the pencils and inks. You know, again, it's probably done all digitally. Great job. Very polished. Good panel layouts. Good page layouts. Good storytelling. I am frankly surprised how good this guy is. And that he hasn't been getting work from the big two before, just based on the strength of his art, what I've seen up to this point. So Red Hood and the Outlaws has been a very good book. I think that a lot of the themes that Scott Lobdell told me that he wanted to explore when we sat down at WonderCon were good themes to explore. They were inherently interesting. And he's done an incredible job so far, especially with the pacing and the plotting. We're on issue 4 now. The team hasn't come together yet, the trio of Red Hood, Artemis, and Bizarro, but all the players are in place. And he's taking his time. He's keeping it interesting. And because of the story he's telling, it's going to, when they do come together, it's going to be that much more impactful. So I think he's done an incredible job so far. All right, up next, now we're going to talk about Supergirl number 3, written by Steve Orlando, art by Brian Ching, and colors by Michael Atelier. I said I was out on Supergirl right from the beginning. Just wasn't my cup of tea. But I've kept reading because they keep sending me the advanced copies, so, you know, why wouldn't I read it? And I'm glad that I have. It didn't really sit that well with me that they totally switched up in the New 52 the identity of who Cyborg Superman was. You know, it used to be Hank Henshaw, classic Superman villain. And it made sense why he had such a chip on his shoulder and was so angry at Superman based on his origin. They've totally flipped it. Cyborg Superman is now Kara's father. I just didn't like that change. It didn't make sense to me at the time. I'm still not sure I totally agree with the choice. If they wanted to have Kara's father come back and be a villain in a way, I think they could have done it differently rather than and made him his own character rather than hijacking somebody else. All that being said, Steve Orlando's doing a great job of making it interesting. This is a great issue. It's a lot of fun. Probably my favorite issue, or the issue that I have enjoyed the most so far on this run. But what's interesting, and one thing I noticed immediately after I finished reading it, I was like, wow, that's the best issue of Supergirl that I've read so far. This was also, the Supergirl issue 3, also the issue that probably had the least in common with the TV show of any issue so far. You know, we see her adoptive parents. They're the same adoptive parents she has in the TV show. We see a tiny bit of the DEO. Other than that, this is all new territory. You know, we don't see her at Catco. We don't see her in high school. We don't see her, you know, doing any of that kind of stuff. It's just a cool Supergirl story in space fighting against her father. And it was enjoyable. The art is starting to grow on me. It's very much a cartoony style that Brian Ching brings. But I feel like it's getting a little less cartoony. And his art is starting to flow a little bit better. And I like a lot of the choices he makes storytelling-wise. So a solid issue. As long as I keep getting advanced copies, I'll keep reading it and telling you guys what I think. But it's still not a book I'm going to go out and buy. But I know you're a big fan, so what were your thoughts on issue 3?
Yeah, I was really happy with it. I'm a big fan of the artwork on it. I love the colors. I love that kind of cartoony, almost anime feel that it has. And I particularly like the choice of Cyborg Superman. Although I kind of keep the faith that maybe there's another Cyborg Superman out there, or is just another robot, kind of like a Terminator, I guess, where one's programmed one way, and this one just happens to be programmed with Kara's father. So that's kind of how I look at it, just to kind of keep an open mind, perspective wise, where it's not necessarily Hank Henshaw and that Cyborg Superman somewhere still out there. But I like playing on her feelings, on how desperate that she is to reclaim her family, her way of life. Because unlike Superman, Supergirl remembers to some degree what her life was before on Krypton. And that always seems to haunt her, whether in the comic books or in the TV show. And I think that's a really big part of her. And with that, these cyborgs, they play on those feelings, and that's how they managed to entrap her to try to, in this case, now take over the world. But there's a lot of really good moments in the book where she sees her mom, she realizes how much she wants her back, but at the same time has the maturity to realize that that's not her mom, that her mom's actually dead. And in her own words, it's just a body held up by metal. So, very well done. Enjoying it a lot so far. And the fact that it differs so much from the TV show is great for me. Although, I am really enjoying the second season of Supergirl so far. This is a really good change of pace for it without going too far. So I am buying this one so far, and I recommend it, especially for younger readers.
Yeah, I would say that's definitely the case. If I had somebody that was looking for a book for a, you know, 10 to 12 year old girl, this would be right up there at the top of the list of recommendations. All right, up next we have Superwoman number 4, written by Phil Jimenez. Normally he does the art as well, but the pencils in this particular issue are by Emmanuel Lupacchino, the inks are by Ray McCarthy, and the colors are by Hi-Fi. Favorite thing about Superwoman number 4, we've got the Lois Lane, the New 52 Lois Lane returns. Is she actually alive? Is she out of phase, like Luthor and the Kryptonite Man that we see in this issue? Is that what went down? Or is she actually a manifestation of Lana Lang? Is Lana Lang losing her mind? Does she have a tumor? We just don't know yet, but it was great to see Lois return. So Jimenez is doing a great job. This was one of those issues that just raised a heck of a lot of questions and gave no answers, but he continues to grow the supporting cast. And I love the fact that this is like a Superman book without Superman. You know, it's kind of like the Gotham Knights was in the Batman universe. It's the Metropolis Police Department. It's Lana Lang. It's Lois Lane. It's Lex Luthor. It's all the supporting cast, but it's not Superman himself. And John Henry Irons Steel as well. So I really enjoyed this issue. It gives me hope that we're going to see Lois Lane return. And they'll have to change the title of the book from Superwoman to Superwomen. Or even better than that would be keep the title the same. And if Lana somehow has to sacrifice her powers to, like, bring Lois Lane back into phase with that reality, that universe, and so she actually exists again, and having the title be Superwoman with just Lois Lane with superpowers, that would be ideal. So, yeah, great book. Again, one that has really, really strong female characters, much like Batgirl and the Birds of Prey. And for that reason, I'm glad that they chose Emmanuelle Lupacchino to be the one that fills in when Phil Jimenez needs a break. You know, it's a book that comes out only once a month, but being that he's writing it also, you know, he's probably going to need every fourth issue or so off, just kind of stay on task and stay on schedule. So Lupacchino draws her women incredibly well. They're not, you know, disproportionate. They're not overly sexualized or anything like that. She does a great job. I love the way that she draws female characters. So great issue. Gives me hope that we're going to see more Lois Lane as Superwoman in the future, especially because I love her costume. Lana Lang's costume is basically the old Superman red costume, and it's just kind of, maybe we'll call her Superwoman orange, but that Lois Lane costume was cool. Are you caught up on Superwoman?
Yeah, I am.
What do you think?
I like how this book is really the great complement to the rest of the Superman titles. You have Action, Superman, and then now you have Superwoman. And also, in the near future, have the book with Jonathan he's going to have his book with Damian. So overall, I mean, you have, like, you get this really good perspective on all the characters. You have Superman with, obviously, Superman and Jonathan. Action seems to be focused a little bit more now on Lex and also on Lois. And this one here, now you have Lana and you have New 52, Lois Lane, who I don't think is coming back. But
no, you think she's just a figment of her imagination?
Yeah, I think she's kind of crazy. I think she's she's having a real hard time dealing with what's going on in her own body. I mean, because we saw what happened with Lois, and I mean, I'd be terrified too if I had those powers. And you know, you were trying to find out what's going on. So it'll be interesting to see going forward whether it was just a figment of her imagination or, in fact, this is Lois trying to reach out to her. But I mean, that letter she left to pre-Flashpoint Lois was pretty clear. I don't know. It's really good, Superwoman, and it would be cool to have her back, but we'll see.
All right, up next we have The Flash number 10, written by Joshua Williamson. Pencils on this issue are by Felipe Watanabe, inks by Eau Claire Albert, and colors by Chris Sotomayor. What do you think of Flash 10?
Flash 10 was good. Growing pains, that's what I call it. I mean, you have the return of the pre-Flashpoint Wally West. You have, I guess, New 52 Wally West. And just growing pains and being a hero. I like the fact that they added the whole battle with some just really obscure villain. And he's really... he thinks he's got it all under control and everything, and it's you know, it's not enough to be fast. You have to pay attention to detail. You have to, you have all kinds of things going on that can really affect the outcome of the situation. So overall, I thought it was done really, really well, and I look forward to see where it goes, because now you tell him his identity, because that seems to be one of the things that really pissed him off, is the fact that old Wally knows who he is, and a couple of other people knows who he is, but he's not allowed to know who Barry Allen is. It becomes that trust issue. So I want to see where it goes from here, and also see who that shadow man is that he goes off on his own.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be Shade. Who's actually,
yeah, it looks like it.
Who's actually normally, I think, more of a Hawkman villain, if I remember correctly. But, yeah, Growing Pains, I totally agree with you. That's a great kind of way to sum up the issue in just a couple words. I love the fact that we saw Papercut, definitely a lesser-known rogue. So that was cool. I guess it's kind of understandable with what Wally found out about whose dad is in the last issue that he's going to have trust issues. And I'm also surprised that Barry hasn't told him. I mean, Barry told Mina who he was, like, at the drop of the hat. And we had a problem with that. We're like, what? He's, like, just telling everybody. But then here's a guy that he has a previous relationship with and a strong personal relationship with, who he's now training as a speedster, and he's not telling him. And Wally can't figure it out, being that they're so close in their civilian identities, and I don't know that I buy that necessarily. But this issue just really showed what a great grasp on the Flash universe that Joshua Williamson has, and also how deep his knowledge and his love of this corner of the DC universe is, bringing in somebody like Papercut, bringing in the next big bad is Shade. So, yeah, I thought it was a pretty solid issue. The art, it was okay. I think it's certainly a step up from last issue. The Jorge Corona issue was the worst art we've seen on Flash up to this point in the Rebirth era, in my opinion. But this art is even a step up above for me, the art of Carmine DiGiandomenico, who's the regular series artist, just because this is a lot cleaner. If there's a fault in Watanabe's art, it's the storytelling from panel to panel. It tends to be a little choppy. The story itself, it felt like it was paced and plotted well. So just reading through the story, you don't really notice it. But if you go through and you're just kind of skimming by just looking at the art, that's where you're going to have a little bit tougher time. It's a little, things are a little bit harder to follow. So all in all, a solid issue of Flash. I'm really glad that Joshua Williamson's on the book. Clearly, he has a great grasp on who these characters are. All right, the last book we're going to talk about is Wonder Woman number 10, written by Greg Rucka, art by Nicola Scott, colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr. This was a really, really cool story. It's basically, this is year one, part four, and this is really like, if I had to pick one moment in the story so far where Princess Diana becomes Wonder Woman, it's in this issue where she discovers that she has this incredible speed and this incredible power to the point where she's able to deflect bullets being fired from an automatic weapon at this family. And it was an incredibly well-written scene, and the rendering, the way that Nicola Scott chose to depict it, was top notch. It was so good. And I love what Fajardo Jr. did with the colors. That page stands out in contrast to the other pages. It's got a little bit of a, I don't know, like a dark overtone almost, that gives it some gravitas, gives it some weight behind it. And how many panels is that? Let's see. 12 panel page Nicola Scott did. It's absolutely incredible. You know, we've been singing the praises of the creative team on Wonder Woman all along. This issue did not let me down whatsoever. And one other thing that I love about what Greg Rucka is doing is here he is telling the origin of Wonder Woman in the year of her 75th anniversary, in the year that she became a UN ambassador, and supposedly telling this tale from the past. And yet, a lot of the themes that he's exploring and a lot of the impetus that he's giving Princess Diana to come to the larger world and to kind of fight for the little guy and her beliefs and the reason she's doing it and the reasons behind her actions are so appropriate to what would make a hero today with all the strife that we have, especially in this country with the recent election and the racial tensions that we have going on and, you know, the other conflicts around the world. It really makes me wish that we had a hero like Wonder Woman, not just because she could save lives, but just because of the ideals that she's representing. And so, like I said, even though this is a story from the past, it's Wonder Woman year one, it's the themes and the things that he's exploring are so absolutely appropriate for the world of today. So incredible job, you know, beautiful Nicola Scott art, so evocative of emotion. She captures emotion and facial expressions and body language better than any artist out there that I can think of that's working in comics today. And yet her art has a soft quality to it, a real beauty to it. Incredible job from everybody in this issue. Loved it. Probably my favorite issue in the year one arc. Well, not probably, definitely my favorite issue in the year one arc story so far, without question. What about you, Manny?
Yeah, this is the issue of Wonder Woman year one that I've been waiting for. The one where she, I guess, reveals herself to the world as a hero. And you couldn't have caught it any, said it any better yourself. Nicola Scott does a fantastic job at rendering this. I mean, there's so many panels where she's not only capturing facial expressions very, very well, but she's capturing movement so, so well. In a couple of the panels where you know where the lasso is going, or you know where she's headed off to. There's one where she's jumping over a fence or whatever you want to call it, and I mean it's just done so well. Then there's a scene where she's covering a grenade. I thought that was pretty cool. And just overall, just the way it begins, really, really mild and kind of where she's in a really vulnerable position because she's no idea what a mall is. As a matter of fact, it seems like she's pretty nervous about it, being surrounded by so many people and stores and sounds and smells and things like that. It seems to be a little bit overwhelming for her. And I mean, she doesn't even know what her powers are. She explains to the group that she was given these gifts by the gods, but she doesn't really know what they are, and that, you know, she'll figure it out as she goes. That they'll present themselves when they need to be. So, in fact, when she's saving these people from gunfire, she's just doing it off of pure instinct. There's no hesitation of, oh, I'm going to get shot or I'm going to get hurt. She just knows that she has to save these people, which yeah, I think even makes it.
She jumps on that grenade having no idea if she can actually survive it or not. That's heroism.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Yeah. So she's putting the lives of others before her. And I thought that was just wonderful. So, yeah, definitely. This is the issue I had been waiting for. And it did not disappoint. It was done so well. I mean, there's nothing you can say about the creative team for Wonder Woman other than fantastic or wonderful. Let's just stick with that word. So, yeah, just looking forward to the next one. I don't know. There's not much more to say. I mean, I'm just going to say how awesome it is. But this is one of those really, really good ones.
All right. Book of the week.
Wonder Woman 10.
No hesitation, no other considerations.
The only other book that I think I would consider, let me just go down the list again. Okay, fine. I'll just give you top three. It's going to be Wonder Woman, Detective, and a tie between
give me
New
four.
Superman and Supergirl. I don't know. So this is a pretty good book this week. Definitely Wonder Woman, and second would be Detective.
Yeah, for me too. 100% agree. Wonder Woman 10, for that moment where she really becomes Wonder Woman in the eyes of the world, or at least in my eyes, that's book of the week without question. But the other book I did consider was Detective Comics 944. But you know what? It's part two of the story. We don't really get any answers to who the victim syndicate is. Not to say it's not a quality book. The art was outstanding. A lot of dialogue, like I said, but it didn't drag. It was very enjoyable. But just based on the fact that there's no like wow moment in Detective 944, I'm going to go with the Wonder Woman title. Now, when we got the books this last Friday, so I guess that would be the 11th, there was also a couple files that I got sent along with the advanced copies, and they were some art previews for Teen Titans issue 2 and 3. Now, issue 2 is a fill-in. You know, we know that John Boy Myers left the book due to creative differences. I was very disappointed to hear that. So, I hope I'm saying this right. Diogenes Neves, with inks by Ray Jose and Sean Parsons. They're doing issue 2. But again, that art team is just a fill-in, because with issue 3, that's beginning Coy Pham's run as the ongoing artist for Teen Titans with Wade Von Grobiger inks. So we got sent a couple zip files, one with some preview art from issue 2 that's fully colored, and also some just black and white, just pencils and inks from issue 3. Did you happen to take a look at those?
I don't think you sent me those.
I put them, you know, maybe
I was looking.
Hold on.
I didn't get those.
I may have forgotten to share them with you. Let me do that now, and you can take a look while I talk about my thoughts on it. So, the Nieves art on issue 2, I thought, is done well. The biggest problem I have with it, and this is going to be a big problem in the trade, is just how different everybody looks from the way John Boy drew them. Specifically, once you get the files, specifically if you look at page 5, they don't look like teenagers. And that was one of the things that I talked about when we were talking about the art from the one Rebirth one-shot and issue 1 that John Boy did. The fact that he did such a great job of making them look like teenagers, of making them look young. Starfire definitely doesn't look young in that particular page, and nor does Raven. Beast Boy, Changeling looks, you know, on the youngish side. Same with Kid Flash. Damien, you can't really tell based on that image, but it's nice art to look at, but in no way does it approach the level of and the tone and the feel that John Boy had on the book. I feel like he was so pitch perfect with what he did, and I was so looking forward to seeing more of his art. So it just, again, disappoints me that he's not on the book anymore. And then going to issue 3 with Coy Pham, who I'm not really familiar with. Most of the work he's done up to this point has been for Marvel. Again, these are uncolored pages, so maybe it'll look colored, but I do not care for his depiction of Damian Wayne at all. He looks deformed. He looks like his head looks like the shape of a baby. You know, it's got that very oval look where it just looks like it's kind of stretched out, and I didn't care for the art at all. I didn't like the page layouts. I didn't like the panel layouts. So I can quickly see me dropping this book, just based on the fact that it's got Damian Wayne, who I'm not a fan of, but you know, John Boy really turned that around at Long Beach. He really got me excited about the book, and then on top of being excited about what plans he and Benjamin Percy had for Damian Wayne, I was like, oh, maybe I'll read it despite that, despite my dislike for Damian Wayne. And then seeing his art on the first couple issues, I just fell in love with it, and I'm like, yeah, I'm in. Well, now he's not on the book at all, so he's not going to be influencing the story of Damian Wayne and getting to explore some of those ideas that he had for the character, and his art's not on the book. So I'll probably wait until I see issue 3 colored, because maybe it'll look a heck of a lot better than it does on these preview pages that I received. But I just don't see how coloring these images is going to overcome what in my mind is very subpar art. Did you get a chance to take a look?
Oh, whoa, that's Damien?
Are you looking at the black and whites?
Yeah, the black and whites.
Yeah, see what I mean?
Yeah, I do, actually. That's a shame, because I love the artwork on number one. And the rebirth.
Yeah, so join me in being disappointed, I guess. It's really too bad. Now look at some of the pages from issue 2. The color ones.
Yeah, they look a little bit older.
Yeah, see what I'm saying?
They definitely do look a little, yeah, especially Starfire.
And Raven.
Kid Flash and Raven.
Yeah.
They definitely look a little bit older.
So again, it's not bad art. The Diogenes Neves art. It's not bad art. It just doesn't have that same feel. That was one of the cool things that John Boy did, was he captured their youth, how young they were, really came across in his in his rendering. So it's just too bad. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking about it more when those issues come out.
Yeah, we'll put them down to where they will be. Or, not their fault, but they should have probably figured out those creative differences beforehand.
Yeah, I really.
Now you're gonna have 3 different sets of artists on the book.
Yeah, I really want to know.
It's gonna look a little. It's gonna look bad on the trade.
Yeah, I really want to know specifics, but we probably never will. I mean, there's a reason they just say creative differences. There's no reason to air the dirty.
Well, maybe we can ask him next time.
Yeah, but even if he were to tell us, it's not something we can talk about on the podcast. There's no reason to air.
It'd be off the record, yeah. But I'd still be curious to know.
Yeah, exactly. Me too. You know, I'd be like, hey, off the record, just to satisfy my curiosity. But anyway, that's going to wrap it up for this episode. Once again, we'd like to thank everyone for joining us. Please visit us at thecomicsourceblog.com for past episodes of the podcast. You can watch episodes of our YouTube channel there, as well as finding a link to Manny's written blog and my written blog, and of course our sketch gallery. You can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Also do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to keep up to date on new episodes and convention coverage. So that's going to do it, everybody. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.